Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom from a beautiful Orange County, Orlando, Florida. A lot of famous people come down here, of course, to bring their children to the happiest place on earth. I don't know if any of you know the business news reader or commentator, Neil Cavuto. I hear he's down here with his family. Well, enough of this name dropping. No, I'm kidding. I wanted to reassure you that I was able to contact our congressman, and there's a footnote in that 1,000-page bill. There's $1 million earmarked for the CCK Entertainment Complex and Gymnasium that we're going to construct right outside of town here. No, I'm kidding. Well, everybody woke up this morning owing $1 trillion more, but other than that, I wish you well. I hope you're having a wonderful day. There is some ecclesiastical history that's taking place, and I don't want to say too much about it and take time away from the sermon, but maybe I'll discuss it more thoroughly with those of you out on the West Coast when we are there. You know, but it does seem to me the way is being prepared for a new and revived work of God in the near future. But anyway, for those of you who have not yet heard or don't know about it, evidently the grapevine is quite active. The drums are beating or however it's getting out there. People know that we're heading out to the West Coast, and so we do have a Sabbath service planned for the town of Chatsworth on March 7th, in the afternoon of March 7th. So those of you who are in the region, if you want to come on over and join us March 7th at Chatsworth. I'm calling this talk Jesus Christ, Some Dynastic History. We're going to do a little bit of history of the dynasty that eventually will lead to the kingdom of God on earth, the dynasty that led to Jesus Christ, who came to, in effect, qualify for the throne and now is ruling from heaven, but will directly rule on earth ultimately, as we know, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, but ruling from Jerusalem. That dynasty was the dynasty of David. And I want to give some dynastic, my talk today is called Jesus Christ, Some Dynastic History. I'm going to give some history of the dynasty of Jesus Christ, just some, but there are lessons to be learned from the portion I'm going to cover. As I've said often, my goal is to give people a database. I want people to know what's in the Bible. I want to try to, you know, cover all over the Bible, not neglect parts, but bring all the parts in as appropriate. I want to begin by going to Acts 13. Now, I want to pay respects to two very great presidents of the United States whom we honor on Monday, George Washington, the founder of the nation in many ways, the father of the nation, as he's called, and then Abraham Lincoln, who, in a sense, saved the nation, saved the dream of the nation as well, the purpose of the nation, one could say. They were leaders of great note in history. And the person I'm going to discuss today at length was a great leader in history. As one of the Israeli politicians of years ago, Benjamin Begin, said, you know, Menachem Begin's son, he talked about Jerusalem, D.C., Jerusalem, David's capital. And though we honor Washington and Lincoln in America, everybody around the world knows the name of King David. And even to this day, not only among Jews is David a popular name, but it's a very popular name in many parts of the world in various forms. You know, King David is a very famous figure and a very important figure in history. And, of course, he's the human ancestor of Jesus Christ. I'd like to make one brief comment, by the way, about the Middle East, because some of you might be expecting me to do that. I remember one time back in the 1970s when I was a faculty member in Big Sandy, Texas, somebody called me up, and the king of Saudi Arabia had just died, and he asked for some comment on that. And I was thinking, well, that's interesting, you know, because even peripheral parts of the Middle East, people thought I knew something about. You know, so if somebody's going to ask me to comment on Saudi Arabia, I would imagine you might want me to comment on Israel. We just had major elections there. I say major because, you know, they were for the national office or parliament there, which is called the Knesset. And I want to say something about Israel just so that you have an awareness. The system there is not like the system here. It's very unlike the system here. When people vote there, they vote for a party. The country is a coalition of political parties. What happens is the whole country votes. And if you get a percent and a half of the vote, 1.5%, then you'll get a seat in parliament. You have to get 1.5% of the total vote. You don't carry a district. You get 1.5% of the total vote of the country. So if you get 1.5%, you get a seat. And then we see how many parties have seats. And we see who the top vote getters are, which parties. They have their leaders. Then their leaders negotiate with the leaders of the other parties, and coalitions are formed. So really the elections are in two parts. First, the voters make their decision about which parties are going to be larger or smaller. Then the parties negotiate over how the government's going to be formed. So it might be another 3 weeks till the government of Israel is formed. And so that's why, you know, elections don't work the same way as they do here, other than the 2000 election, which some people are still arguing over. You know, we normally know who the president is right away. In Israel, it may take a few weeks, but my guess would be is that Benjamin Netanyahu will be the next prime minister eventually, and he's very popular in America, probably more popular here than he is over there. Anyway, to get back to the subject at hand, back in ancient times, David was the ruler, and he was the ancestor of Jesus Christ, and he's very important in history because a lot of things that happened to him foreshadowed Jesus Christ's ministry and life. You see, David was the psalmist. He wrote the hymnal for the church, and the hymns are filled with prophecies of Christ. And if you know the Psalms, you know an awful lot about Christ because the Psalms predicted so much about his life. In fact, as Christ was dying, he quoted from the Psalms. So David's life had many episodes in it that he wrote about in the Psalms, and they were also prophecies of Christ, which we'll even see today. And in Acts 13, David is spoken of here. Paul speaking, and in verse 21 of Acts 13. And afterward, they asked for a king. By the way, I read this recently, over the last couple of weeks at services. And I'm noticing lately that I seem to be connecting. One service tends to connect with another. It's not necessarily pre-planned. It tends to work that way. This was a verse I read recently. Acts 13:21. And afterward they asked for a king, so God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man in the tribe of Benjamin for 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will. You know, paraphrasing from the Old Testament. So David was a man after God's heart who would do all his will. From this man's seed, you know, comes the Messiah, the anointed one, Mashiach ben David, the Messiah, the son of David, Christos, Christ. From this man's seed, according to the promise, God raised up for Israel, and of course also for the whole world, for Israel a Savior, Jesus. So David was a man after God's own heart, but David was a man. And David had the difficulty of being a king. And being a king in those days gave you a tremendous amount of power. And even nowadays, you know what happens when people get into political office. It is a corrupting factor in someone's life when everybody is telling him all the time, you know, oh, your majesty, yes, your majesty, and kowtowing to him and flattering him and seeking favors, you know, and all of that, you know, and you begin to unfortunately believe your press releases, which can be very dangerous, you know. It's corrupting to have so much power. And David had to deal with that. And he wasn't always successful. As great a man as he was, he sometimes stumbled very badly. But he recognized that, and he bitterly repented of that. And so by the time he came to the end of his life, he had, spiritually speaking, pretty much put his house in order in that sense. But look at what he says near the end of his life. Go to 2 Samuel 23. 2 Samuel 23. Now, these are the last words of David, okay? So these are very critical, you know. You want to be known by what you say at the end. Thus says David, the son of Jesse. Thus says the man raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel. You know, this is how I'm known. I'm known as the poetic David, the as well as the warrior David, you know, the psalmist David. The Spirit of the Eternal spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. You know, a man under whom I worked for many years, Mr. Raymond McNair, who recently died, used to quote this verse so often. Whenever I read this verse, I think of how often Raymond McNair used to quote it. The Rock of Israel spoke to me. Or the God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, like the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. So even as he gives his last words, he kind of waxes eloquent, being the man that he was, the poet that he was. And look at what he says here, though. Although my house is not so with God. So he recognized he had made some very serious mistakes, and he had a dysfunctional family as a result. And it was very tragic for him and tragic for the nation. Although my house is not so with God, yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire. Will he not make an increase? Indeed he will, and he did. You know, that covenant he made to David is the covenant that was the promise that gave us Jesus Christ, and ultimately his kingdom will be an eternal kingdom, will include all the universe. So indeed that covenant will be increased and increased and increased, as we know. So David recognized his own flaws and God's mercy in dealing with him. So we're going to get into some of that today. And his problems led to some very serious problems in his reign, in the dynasty of David, you know, the beginning of the Davidic dynasty. Because he was a king that was supposed to be one of many, many, many who would rule. And indeed that has happened. There have been many Davidic rulers over time. I'd like to go now to 2 Samuel. And in 2 Samuel, we find, just to summarize some of the history here, for you know, to try to save some time, David was polygamous in during much of his life, and he had therefore children by various wives and concubines. He had concubines, presumably he had some children by them too, but he had children by various women, and so they were like half brothers and half sisters. They had the same father. But they would have had different mothers, of course. And he had a son, Amnon. Amnon would have been the heir apparent. He was the firstborn of David. But Amnon lusted after his half-sister. He had a half-sister. She was a child of another mother, Tamar. And Amnon raped Tamar. The horrible thing to have happen in a family. Well, Tamar's brother, not her half-brother, but her full-brother, Absalom, was very, very upset about this. And evidently David never properly punished Amnon, which is rather a shocking thing. But if you read 2 Samuel 13, if that's where you are, verse 21, now evidently this matter was generally hushed up, so I don't know if it became a public matter in those days. I mean, obviously we know about it from the Bible, but in those days it might have been pretty well kept quiet. In fact, there's, I believe, Dr. Hay, a scholar whom I greatly respect, I believe that he actually studied into the matter, and here is what he used to teach, was that actually at some point David left the Middle East for a time, or either him or representatives of his, and sailed to the British Isles, where there were already Israelite colonies at that time, and actually married Amnon to a member of the royal family at that time ruling over Ireland. There were Jews in Ireland at that time who were ruling in Ireland, and evidently David took this daughter and married her to somebody there. I believe that was something Dr. Hay used to talk about. Obviously, it's not in the Bible, so you can just take it as something that may be the case, and if I can do further research on that, or you can. But to get back to the story, here's how David reacted in verse 21. But when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. All right, yeah, very angry. But what do you do with your firstborn son? Now, maybe because he was the firstborn son, because he was the heir apparent, he didn't want to publicly to do anything to punish him in a major way because it would somehow create some scandal. I don't know what his motivations were, but I don't see here anything that he did to Amnon other than maybe, you know, not having much to do with him for a while, but there doesn't seem to be any punishment here. Well, Absalom took the law into his own hands, and that what he did wasn't right either. But what he did was he connived, and he worked out a way where he could be with Amnon, and he and his servants, and then he had his servants murder him. So Amnon, who had raped his sister, he had murdered. Absalom ordered his murder. So this is going on within a family, within the royal family. That's terrible. You hear about the scandals today in the royal family. You know, this is worse than what we've heard about, unless you want to believe that Diana was done away with, which I don't believe that's true. Anyway, so you have this scandal here in the royal family. Now Absalom flees, because now that he's murdered Amnon, he's not going to stick around. So now Absalom flees and goes to his grandfather. But David is very upset about it, and Joab, David's commander, understands it, so he works out a reconciliation, okay? So I'm trying to summarize the story. So now let's say the reconciliation is worked out, and now Absalom comes back. So let's go to the end of chapter 14 now. Let's first say a few things about Absalom. Well, Absalom comes back, verse 24. Let's go to 23. So Joab arose. This is 2 Kings 14:23. So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. So now this son is back. You know, he had murdered his half-brother who had raped his sister. And now he's back, Absalom. And the king said, "Let him return to his own house, but do not let him see my face." Obviously, the king is upset that Absalom has murdered his firstborn son, his half-brother, Absalom's half-brother. But the king doesn't do anything to Absalom other than just keep him away from court, you know, because he understands the motivation there, revenge for his sister. You know, so Absalom returned to his own house but did not see the king's face. Now, in all Israel, there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. Absalom, the father of peace. But what kind, you know, unfortunately, he didn't fulfill that prophecy. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. So he was good-looking. The ladies loved him, you know. He was the rock star of his day. You know, he would have been on the cover of People magazine if they would have had it back then and so on. Us magazine, whatever. National Enquirer would have been commenting on him. Verse 26, and when he cut the hair of his head at the end of every year, so he had one haircut a year. So maybe he was a rock star. Anyway, and when he cut it, the hair of his head, at the end of every year he cut it, because it was heavy on him. Yeah, I would imagine. When he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels according to the king's standard. Now, in the new revised standard version of the Bible claims this is around 5 pounds of hair. So I guess that's a pretty good head of hair. He grew every year about 5 pounds worth of hair, and it, you know, he would have the big occasion of the cutting, and I imagine it was a big deal. You know, the women would swoon. Anyway, to Absalom were born 3 sons, and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. Perhaps he named her after his sister. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. And Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem, but did not see the king's face. Therefore, Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. And when he sent again, the second time he would not come. So he said to his servants, this is in verse 30, "See, Joab's field is near mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." Oh, no. And Absalom's servant set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and came to Absalom's house and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" And by the way, speaking of that, our thoughts and prayers are with the Australians at this time. And we do have now American firefighters who are down there. So, you know, please keep them in your thoughts and prayers. Anyway, in verse 32, "And Absalom answered Joab, 'Look, I sent to you saying, come here so that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. But if there is iniquity in me, let him execute me.'" You know, what I did, I feel I had the right to do because of what Amnon did to my sister. But if he wants to deal with me, let him deal with me. But I don't want to be shunned in this way. Now, quite frankly, there's another side to this, a seamier side. Absalom, by killing Amnon, had gotten rid of a competitor, his major competitor for the throne, because Amnon was the firstborn of David. And also, by seeing David now, he's developing his own credibility as the heir to the David's throne. Absalom was a very ambitious man, and unfortunately, that got the better of him. So Joab went to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. Then the king kissed Absalom. So they're back together again, father and son, but Absalom is now plotting against the king. After this had happened, that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. So he's taking advantage of the fact that he's a prince, and he's acting like a prince, but he's also plotting against his own father. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was, whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." So he actually made it seem like, you know, the king was too busy and I'll be willing to listen, but the king doesn't really want to listen. And yet, yeah, you sure are being mistreated, aren't you? That sort of thing. So he's, you know, cultivating loyalty and turning people against the king. Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice." So he began, over a period of time, to turn public opinion against his own father. And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. So he was very friendly, very cordial, you know, a real politician in every way. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He became the charismatic, popular figure. David became more distant, more aloof. Absalom was mingling more with everybody and getting really popular. Now, there are these types in organizations, and maybe you've seen them. I'm aware of one particular person that I'm thinking of. I don't want to mention his name, but there are people of that sort. You know, they try to seem like they're the good old boy. They're the one that's willing to mingle with everybody. And, yeah, oh, shucks, you know, I'm just folks like y'all, and I just want what's best for you and that sort of thing, you know. Now, it came to pass after 40 years. Now, David had been anointed in his teens, and now 40 years later, he faces the greatest crisis of his life, you know, late in his dynastic career, after having been anointed by Samuel 40 years earlier, that Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go to Hebron and pay a vow which I made to the Eternal." So he's not going to Hebron to pay a vow. Hebron was an ancient city of great importance to Judah, and it's where David began his reign. First he reigned over Judah, then over the whole of Israel from Jerusalem. But he was going to Hebron to, in effect, as part of an insurrection against his own father. "For your servant took a vow while I dwelt at Geshur in Syria, saying, 'If the Eternal indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Eternal.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose and went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron.'" So he began to, he really had developed an organization. He was evidently quite talented and had talented people with him, and developed an organization and built an undercurrent against his father. Now his father was evidently, you know, blindsided. He didn't think his own son could be capable of such a thing, evidently. You know, he loved his son, and he just couldn't believe the worst about his own son. So this was going on as it were under the nose of David. Terrible, a conspiracy. "And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything." So they weren't aware of what he was trying to pull off. "Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city, from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number." So at first, they didn't know what he was doing. But after a while, he got, you know, them to follow him and love him and think of him as somebody great. So then they would believe the stories he was telling about his father. He would badmouth his father. And after a while, you know, when he had confidence of those people, he was the one that they knew more intimately. You know, he was the one that was right there with him, rubbing shoulders with him. So he could tell them stories about his dad in Jerusalem, and they would believe it. This is a satanic thing, and it's the kind of thing that Satan probably did in his time, you know, back, you know, in prehistory. I don't want to get into all that today, but it's a satanic kind of thing, you know, for the local official to turn people against the official farther, you know, higher up the line, and for his own purposes. Now, Ahithophel was a counselor of David and a friend of David and a trusted advisor of David, and he represents a type of Judas. Some of the things that David says about Ahithophel, they apply to Judas as a prophecy of Judas. And Ahithophel's fate, his destiny, was the same as the destiny of Judas. And I want to turn to Psalm 55, and a lot of you are familiar with this psalm, but I want to go to Psalm 55, where David talks about Ahithophel, and it's a prophecy of Judas. Christ was betrayed by one of his own disciples, the treasurer of the group, the one who controlled the money bags of the church, you might say. Judas, and how did Judas betray Christ? By going up to him and kissing him, Rabbi, and he kissed him, and then, and that way he pointed him out to those who wanted to arrest him at that night, because they wanted to make sure they got him, because he might, disappear under the cover of darkness or in the crowd, so he wasn't necessarily weird looking like you see in the movies where everybody, wow, you could see him a mile away and know who it is. No, he looked like anybody else. He wasn't that tall or that, whatever, that he just looked different. And so, with hair down to his ankles or whatever, like Absalom evidently had. He didn't have a hairstyle like Absalom that he had to cut once a year like Absalom did. So when Judas betrayed him with a kiss. So let's look at Psalm 55. You're there. Verse 12. For it was not an enemy who reproaches me. For it is not an enemy who reproaches me. Then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me. Then I could hide from him. But it was you, a man my equal, my companion and my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked in the house of God in the throng. You whom I respected, you were in my kitchen cabinet, as it were. You were right there intimately advising me. You've turned against me. What a bitter pill to swallow. And so, as I said, Ahithophel is a type of Judas. And we'll see what happens to him eventually. Now let's go to the back to 2 Samuel 15. Now a messenger came to David saying, in verse 13, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. So David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. So he had to flee from his own son. So don't think he didn't pay for this problem he had with Bathsheba, for some of his own failings. He was forgiven, and he will live eternally, and he'll rule over Israel in the millennium. But he had a price to pay in his lifetime for what he did wrong. There's a price to pay when you do wrong, even though you're ultimately forgiven. But sometimes there's a price to pay. Like if I hope this doesn't happen, but if I were to go out and rob a bank, theoretically I could repent of it and be forgiven of it, but society's still going to demand, at least it used to, that I would have to pay a price for such a thing, Anyway, so David is fleeing from Absalom. And the king's servant said to the king, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. So he had his loyal people too. And loyalty is a good thing. Obviously, you should be loyal to God first of all. But you should also be a person who is loyal to his employer as well, loyal to his family. Loyal to your nation, etc., You know those things. But loyalty, of course, has its limits when it comes to being immoral for the sake of loyalty. But loyalty is a good thing. And so they were loyal to David. So David has to flee. And notice here in verse 27, there were two great priests, Zadok and Abiathar. And Abiathar had a son, Ahimaaz. And, let's go to verse 27. Then the king said to Zadok, the priest, are you not a seer? You're one who sees the future, You're a person who's a prophetic person. Return to the city in peace and your two sons with you, Ahimaaz your son and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. So the other priest had a son named Jonathan. So we have Jonathan and Ahimaaz and Zadok and Abiathar. And they returned to Jerusalem. Why? Because they were going to be David's eyes and ears. In effect, they were going to be spies. And so they stayed there in Jerusalem, and Absalom didn't go after them right away because they were high priests, they were important, and they didn't outwardly oppose him, so he didn't go after them. But later on, when there was news to report, Ahimaaz and Jonathan sneaked out and went to David, and the story of their flight to David is very exciting. It would make a very good, Mission Impossible adventure or whatever else, 24, whatever, people are watching nowadays, some great adventure story. But I don't have time to cover it, but you'll see it in the next chapter. But in the meantime, David is running, and the country is in a disastrous situation, a civil war where the son is challenging the father, and not just any father, but David, you know, whom God had chosen. So just a terrible time in the history of Israel, you know, much like what we went through in the 1860s that you probably heard about on Thursday. You know, on Thursday, Americans noted that Abraham Lincoln would have been 200 years old if he were still alive. And ironically, Charles Darwin as well, kind of interesting, over in England. Anyway, in verse 31, then someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. Remember, I just read Psalm 55 to you, some of it. Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Eternal, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. He has kept this advisor that was my trusted advisor, who turned out to be a turncoat, a traitor. Frustrate his counsel, David prayed, and God honored that prayer. Now, it's a matter of time here. Let's just save time and say this. There was another counselor named Hushai, and David sent him back. He said, you go back there, because I don't want you to risk your life fighting for me. I'd rather have you back there giving bad advice to my enemy. Do that. So he sent him back. And he said, you give the bad advice, and then Jonathan and Ahimaaz can tell me the news about whether the bad advice was accepted. So all of you see what's happening now? Okay, so David had his fifth columnist back there too. You know, two can play at this game, you might say. When you go to war, that's what happens. War is a horrible thing. As General Sherman said, speaking of the Civil War, the famous quotation, war is hell. And there's an interesting comment on that, by the way. You know, often the terrible toll is paid by families. You know, in a war, the husband is gone, the father is gone. I remember there was a movie I saw where a woman married to a heroic commander says, you know who said war is hell? Mrs. Sherman, you know. Anyway, if you go to 2 Samuel 16... I'm going to jump ahead. I'm going to jump ahead from to the end of 2 Samuel 16. Let's go to verse 15. 2 Samuel 16:15. Meanwhile, Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. This turncoat. And it was when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom that Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. You know, so he's acting like he really, you know, is favorable to Absalom. He's there as a plant, if you remember. All right? So Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? By the way, David, David's name, one of his meanings of his name is beloved. And he is a beloved figure, of course. And Hushai said to Absalom, no, but whom the Eternal and this people and all the men of Israel choose, I will be with him. I will remain. Furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son? As I have served in your father's presence, so will I be in your presence. So he convinced him that he had turned over to him. He turned his loyalty over to him. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give advice as to what we should do. So he began to give him advice. And let's go to chapter 17 now. Now, obviously, there are a lot of details that you can study on your own. And maybe that's good. You know, maybe it's good if I want to give you part of it, because that way you'll dig in maybe and study more on your own. 2 Samuel 17. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, now let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. Here was his logic. David is discouraged. He's depressed. He's confused. He's been thrown out. Get him while he's weak. Get him before he can regroup. You know, get him now. Strike while the iron is hot. Move fast, right? What the Germans call blitzkrieg, lightning war. You know, in 1967, when the Israelis defeated all of the Arab world in 6 days, one German newspaper had a headline, Blitzkrieg, Blitzsieg. You know, lightning war, lightning victory. And that's what Ahithophel wanted here. I will come upon him while he is weary and weak and make him afraid, and all the people who are with him will flee, and I will strike only the king. Then I will bring all the people to you. When all return except the man whom you seek, all the people will be at peace. And the saying pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. The advice seemed good, but God was intervening here. So he also asked Hushai, who was also a respected advisor, well, what's your opinion? And Hushai gave him different advice. Now, David had trusted in God to intervene for him. Things looked very bleak for him. This young, charismatic son of his had gathered all these people against him. He was right now, you know, if surveys were taken, he was, what do you call this, approval rating? His approval rating would have been down, David's, and Absalom would have had, you know, everybody's approval, you know, and so on. So this was a bad time for David, but David had confidence in God. God had chosen him, as we understand. So before we go further with this story, let's go to Psalm 3. Psalm 3, and you see David's faith here. Even though perhaps more people were with Absalom at this point, but David had faith. Psalm 3. Now, by the way, these psalms have titles, and they are a part of the psalm. It's one of my pet peeves. That people don't read the titles to these psalms. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes the Bible also has their own comments. That's what the translator puts in. You don't necessarily read that, but read the title of the psalm. So here is the title of this psalm. A psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. All right? Everybody know when he wrote it? A psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Eternal, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are those who say of me, there is no help for him in God. Selah. People think God has abandoned me, but I know better. But you, O Eternal, are a shield for me. You know, the Israeli flag has what is called the Magen David, or the Mugen David, Mogen David. You know, the shield of David. And, you know, God looked at David looked at God as his shield. And the so-called Jewish star is called... sometimes the Star of David. In Hebrew, it's called Magen David, the Shield of David. The reason why some people chuckle at Mogen David is there's this wine that's called Mogen David. Some people used to call it M&D wine, Mad Dog wine. But anyway, it's a very popular wine, though. Anyway, to get back to the account here, he was David's shield, his Magen. Many are those who say of me, there is no help for him in God, Selah. But you, O Eternal, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Eternal with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill, Selah. Once again, he wants you to pause and meditate. This is a short psalm, but it's intended to be reflected upon. Three times Selah is here, evidently wanting you to reflect on these thoughts. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Eternal sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Eternal, save me, O my God. Lo ira mirivot am asher saviv shatu alai. Kuma Adonai hoshieni. See, these words are very well known to yeshiva students. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Eternal, save me, O my God. For you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Eternal. Your blessing is upon your people. Selah. Think about it. So this was David's confidence in God. But it is true that physically he was in bad shape at this moment, and it would have been a vulnerable time to be attacked. So that's why Ahithophel said, go get him. But here's what Hushai said. Let's go back to 2 Samuel 17. So Hushai, verse 7, 2 Samuel 17, 7, said to Absalom, the advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. For, said Hushai, you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is a man of war and will not camp with the people. You know, so he's giving, you know, a reasonable argument because David did have a temper. David was a warrior. So it's reasonable that he would be fighting mad, as it were. Surely by now he is hidden in some pit or in some other place, and it will be when some of them are overthrown at the first that whoever hears it will say, there is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. See, the first encounter you might lose because he might ambush your people, and then everybody will say you're losing and they'll turn against you. You know, you want to have a first time out, you want to be a winner. And even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore, I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, right from north to south. like the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So you go and you lead this vast army, and then you'll win. Take some time and consolidate. So we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men who are with him there shall not be left as much as one. Moreover, if he has withdrawn into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes into that city, and we will pull it into the river until there is not one small stone found there. So Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than the advice of Ahithophel. Now, why did they take that advice? Because God was intervening. I'm reading the rest of the verse. For the Eternal had purposed to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel, to the intent that the Eternal might bring disaster on Absalom. All right, then these young men, went out and somehow managed to escape and let David know what was happening. So now we have the war, the battle. You know, David prepares, and again, to save time, let's go to verse 27. Because while we're reading these accounts of politics and warfare and so on, we don't want to lose some of the spiritual lessons here. One of the lessons was David's confidence in God. You know, another lesson is how God intervened for David, and how even though David seemed to be, the weaker of the two, he wound up being the winner. So often that happens in God's plan. Now, another thing to remember is that David had a sense of gratitude. If you were good to David, he remembered it. He was not ungrateful. He realized the importance of having people, who to be there for you when you need it. Now, I have had that in my life. I've had people who were there for me when I needed help, and I have, always been very grateful to those people, remembering them in my prayers. And if they were to come to me for help, I would try certainly to help them if I heard that they needed help and so on. Now, this is in verse 27. Now, it happened when David had come to Mahanaim that Shobi, the son of Nahash from Rabbah, of the people of Ammon, Maker, the son of Amiel from Lodebar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogelim, brought beds and basins, earthen vessels and wheat, barley and flour, parched grain and beans, lentils and parched seeds, honey and curds, sheep and cheese of the herd, for David and the people who were with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Now Barzillai was an old man, but he did want David to take care of a man who probably was his son, which David did do. And David was grateful to Barzillai all his life for what Barzillai had done for him. Now notice 2 Kings 2. David is dying, and he still remembers Barzillai. In 2 Kings 2:7, this is where David is talking to Solomon, who eventually was his successor. 2 Kings 2 and verse 7. Oh, I'm sorry, 1 Kings, I apologize. Obviously, if I'm in 2 Samuel, now I have to go to 1 Kings. Otherwise, David would have lived a whole lot longer than he did. Yeah, all right, I'm in 2 Kings. All of you are already in 1 Kings, right? All right, I'm sorry about that. Let's go to 1 Kings 2. David only lived 70 years. All right, so let's go to 1 Kings 2 and verse 7. And here's what David says as he's dying. But show kindness to the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table. For so they came to me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. So don't forget when you're down and out who your friends are. Don't forget that. All right, anyway, let's go to 2 Samuel. And all of us have those times. You know, I remember this country western song back in 1968, stand by me because it's my time. You know, every once in a while, you need your friends. All right. Let's go back to 2 Samuel now. And now we come to the 18th chapter, and now we come to the war, the actual battle. Now David loved Absalom, and you can understand his feeling about Absalom. He there's a lot of reasons why Absalom went bad, you might say. And David maybe took some personal responsibility. Maybe he blamed some of his own mistakes as a parent and as a king. You know, but he loved Absalom. Obviously, Absalom was doing wrong, but he wanted to spare his life. He seemed to have hope that there could be still a reconciliation, even though Absalom had turned against him. He loved his own son. you know, it's interesting. You see in that prayer that David prayed to God, he didn't single out Absalom for invective there. He trusted God to protect him and punish his enemies, but he didn't single out Absalom for some kind of, like, I disown him, I despise him, and so on. He's no son of mine. And that's not the way he acted. Let's go now to what he says about Absalom. Verse 5. I'm in 2 Samuel. This time it is 2 Samuel. Chapter 18, verse 5. Now the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. All right, so he did not want Absalom killed. Obviously, you have to win the battle, but you don't necessarily have to kill every last person, and you don't have to kill Absalom. If you can avoid killing him, avoid killing him. Verse 9. Then Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, like an oak. And his head caught in the terebinth. Well, he was vain about his hair. He had a really thick head of hair, evidently. And he got caught by his hair. Isn't that, you know, what a weird thing. But, you know, that's what happens. You know, the truth is stranger than fiction. He's hanging by his hair, you know, from a tree. But also, that's how God humiliates those who would be so arrogant as Absalom was, turning against his own father. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth. And, well, now he's a sitting target, right? Sitting duck, as it were. And the mule, which was under him, went on. So off goes the mule, and he's hanging by his hair from the tree. Then a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree. So Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him, and why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt. But the man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise up my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king commanded you, and Abishai and Ittai saying, beware lest anyone touch this young man Absalom. Well, Joab had a different agenda. You know, he figured this king is soft-headed, soft-hearted about his own son. His son needs to be gotten rid of. And that's how Joab thought about it. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life, this man says. He doesn't want to be disloyal to David. For there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. You know, you would have carried out his will against me if I had done anything to Absalom. Then Joab said, I cannot linger with you. And he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. Obviously, this is going to hurt you greatly, could kill you. But perhaps he was not totally dead. I suppose he was dying, but not totally dead. By that time, he'd fallen from the tree. Verse 15, and 10 men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom, struck and killed him. So evidently, the 3 spears to the heart, for whatever reason, didn't kill him. He might have died eventually, but it might have been a slower death. Perhaps he had some protection he was wearing. So they actually, beyond the three spears, these 10 men struck him and killed him. So now, you know, they knew he was dead for sure. You know, I guess sometimes some people can linger on the battlefield and just be there and die slowly. But they didn't want to risk that he might recover. So they, as it says, they didn't want to risk that he might recover. So they struck him and killed him. So Joab blew trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. And, of course, although evidently from the account here, Joab didn't want David to immediately know about this, he did find out about it. I'm in verse 31 now. Then the Cushite came. There were 2 runners that went to David with the news, and here is the runner who's going to tell him about Absalom. I'm in verse 31 of 2 Kings 18. Is everybody following the story until now? You're not confused with the various names that I've given you and the details? I'm trying not to confuse everyone. I hope the thread of the story is flowing all right here. It's coherent. All right. Just then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, so evidently it could be an Ethiopian. It's interesting how many times you find people of African descent in biblical accounts, if that's who this person is, it would seem. There is good news, my lord the king. For the Eternal has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? So the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm Be like that young man. See, that's how he thought about it. But that's not how David got the news, obviously. David was still hoping that he could win the battle, and yet his son could be spared, and that there would still be some hope for his son and for their relationship. So this was just a terrible blow to David. So instead of being grateful for the victory, his feeling was remorse, mourning for his son. Verse 33, it's so famous. I'm sure those of you who are students of literature have probably read this account in your literature classes. Verse 33, then the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. O Absalom, my son, my son. So God had restored the throne of David, had dealt with a very wicked person, but yet at the same time, David was so saddened about the death of his son, and he said, I wish it could have been the other way. I wish I could have died for you. Now, David was the ancestor of Jesus Christ. Now, let's think about the analogy that I'm about to make. I want to go to the book of Romans. One of the lessons we can learn from this account is David as a type of Christ, and frankly, Absalom as a type of each of us. Each of us sinned. Each of us were sinners. Each of us, in that sense, had betrayed our Father, our Creator God. And yet, God was willing to die in our stead. As David said, I wish I could have died for you, Absalom. Well, God did, in fact, in the person of Jesus Christ, die for us. You know, in that sense, David died for Absalom in the theology of Christianity. I want to go to Romans, the fifth chapter. Romans, the fifth chapter. Christians have a true hope, a hope which is based on, grounded in Scripture, the hope of eternal life. In verse 5 of Romans 5, now hope does not disappoint. You know, the hope that we have is not a hope that's going to disappoint. Because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, which was given to us. We have received God's Spirit if we're in the church of God. For when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. He died for the sinner, for each of us. Now, here is how wonderful that act is, if you think about it. Verse 7, for scarcely for a righteous man will one die. How many people will die for even a good person, will give their life even for a good person? Well, who's going to give his life for a criminal? God did. Jesus Christ gave his life for sinners, for criminals. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. It could happen, but how many people want to die for a criminal? But God, verse 8, demonstrates his own love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So Christianity has a beautiful lesson to teach us, and we can derive that lesson as we read the account there of David and Absalom. We can understand how God loves us even when we sin, and how he sees potentially what we can be, and he gives us the means to get there. Through Jesus Christ, we can be the kind of people we should be, and then ultimately can be the kind of people that can be with God forever. We can be spirit in God's family through his plan of salvation. Verse 8 of Romans 5, but God demonstrates his own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Verse 9, much more then, having now been justified by his blood, all right, the slate has been wiped clean. We shall be saved from wrath through him. Now that we've had the relationship restored with God, now we can look forward to the next step, which is to be, in effect, reborn, resurrected as spirit. Verse 10, for if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. So I hope this instruction will then inspire us all to become more effective Christian commandment keepers. Well, thanks to those of you who were listening or who may listen later on. We'll have information or we already have information out online about the services in California. But services will be here next week at the same time, probably the same location. There may be more here attending at that time. We'll see about that. Anyway, have a wonderful Sabbath. All the best to you and yours.